traffic paradigm is built on a different concept. It's a concept of bridging the gap between mainstream and alternative studies. If we're going to have a real future in these fields, eventually we have to do this. We have to be confronted with this path that we have to build and join these things together. This, in a sense, what I see is a movement of a new era in this school. One day, we'll all look back and we'll say, we saw history in the making.
Folks, give a hand for Thomas Busfield.
Well, folks, you know that introduction. Here we are again. It's another episode of Shifting Paradigms with your host, Thomas Fusco, on the IPBN-FM network. And if you want to tune in and into the chat room, this is going to be an open chat Tuesday night. We're going to talk about a variety of different things. And you're welcome to come in and introduce the subject, and we'll talk about it. So if you want to do that, go to ipbn-fm.com, and you'll see the listen and chat link at the top of the page. And then you'll be able to click on that and get into the chat room. And you'll be able to listen to the feed and join in the conversation, introducing a topic, and we'll talk about it. I'm already getting something in the chat room that says that the sound might be a little choppy in there. So that's Rick. And so I don't know, maybe it'll straighten out with a little bit of refreshing on the web pages. Boy, we have a very different world now with all this technology and the computer feeds and all that. It's hard for an old fart like me to keep up with it all. I'm used to the old analog radio. But anyway, if you want to come in the chat room and introduce an item to talk about, we'll certainly do that. our phone lines are not being manned this evening. So we do not have a call-in number. So if you want to get into the conversation, you'll have to go into the chat room. And we'll look for you. I've got another computer. I told you I had the second computer up and running for a few weeks now. It's been doing real well. Nice big screen. So I don't have to kind of share both the interface window and the web site chat room window on the same screen. I could look at two different computers, kind of angle my chair a little bit here, sit back and sip some lemonade or whatever else, coffee, and check it all out. Anyway, folks, we're going to talk about a number of different things tonight. It's kind of a little bit of a variety show. One of the things I wanted to talk about was a subject that I recently was making some rather lengthy comments on Facebook about. And what this had to do was the recent flurry of comments that I've seen on Facebook and other social media about tax inequality and jobs going overseas and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, we understand what there are some odd issues going on with that. One of the posts talked about various major corporations like GE that doesn't pay any taxes at all. Although I'm sure that that's in a certain confined area, because certainly taxes are being paid on some level in services, raw materials, all that kind of thing. But it does seem on the surface to be very, very, very bizarre. and very strange and very unfair and all that kind of stuff. And one of the things that I pointed out, and I wanted to make this very clear, was that corporations pay no income taxes. What? That sounds crazy. That sounds insane. No, it's reality. Corporations, not just GE, but corporations do not pay income taxes. Now, why don't they pay income taxes? Well, that's because their consumers, the customers of their products and services, pay the corporate income taxes. You didn't really think they just made a profit on a certain product or service and then just took their taxes out of that profit, did you? I hope you didn't think that. The reality is that whatever taxes they have to pay are built into their pricing, the cost of their goods and services. And all corporations do the same thing. It's not that one has an advantage while another doesn't.
That was pretty awesome, whoever did that.
We got some crosstalk going on this one. I don't know what's going on. It sounded like the connection was haunted for a second. Maybe it's a internet radio EVP, but it doesn't. I don't hear it now. Anyway, all corporations are subject to this same kind of idea, where they put their expenses for their taxes or whatever other fees they have to pay out within their goods and services. So in the end, let's say GE, for example, a big consumer company, makes appliances, makes light bulbs. We all know that about GE. They have enterprises all over the world. It's an international company. When we buy their light bulbs, when we, the consumer, buy their products, we are paying the corporate taxes. It comes out of our pockets. And so I'm sitting there and looking at these various posts on Facebook and other sites talking about all this great inequality that these people are not paying, or these corporations are not paying their quote unquote fair share. You know, what I'm talking about, folks, is not about being conservative or liberal or Democrat or Republican, or, you know, I watch MSNBC and I watch Fox News, and it's not about anything like that at all. It's about the reality. It doesn't matter. Conservative, liberal, Democrat, Republican, it doesn't make any difference. This is just the way the system works, that corporations pass on their expenses to their consumers in the form of goods, the prices for goods and services. That's just the way it is. So let's say for GE, for example, we're going to make GE pay its fair share. That's what we're going to do. We're going to make them pay their fair share. Okay. So now, where do you go with this? Let's say, let's tack 5% on to every item they have just so they can pay a huge income tax. Every light bulb you buy now costs 5% more. Every washer machine that you buy, remember, it's not going to be just from GE. All the manufacturers across the board are going to do the same kind of thing. They're going to pass on the goods and services to, you know, to the consumer. I just saw something on Amazon. Now, this will get you. This is how it works. This is kind of funny, but this is the way things are. Amazon recently sent me an email telling me about a change in plans as far as how I'm compensated. Now, wait until you hear this. You'll like this. What it's saying is that, for example, my book, Behind the Cosmic Veil, does have an outlet through Amazon, and they do sell internationally. So part of my contract with Amazon means that they can sell their book, my book, in all different parts of the world. England, Africa, Australia, you name it. If you're there, you can get this book. And Japan happens to be one of those countries. Well, Japan just recently instituted an 8% consumption tax. That's huge. 8% is big. And the purchases or the sales of books through Amazon.com is applicable to this particular tax. So if they buy a book through Amazon.com that is accessed from their Japanese site and it would be shipped to Japan, they have to pay an 8% tax, a new consumption tax on that purchase. Now, people would figure, oh, okay, all right, the book costs $20, and then they have to pay 8% on top of it, which would be another $1.60 on 20 bucks. And so you figure, well, it should kind of work like it does normally, where people pay the $20 and the $1.60, so they would pay out a $21.60. Oh, no, no, no. Not Amazon. What Amazon's doing is this. They're telling the publishers who have books that are sold through them, look, we sell your book over in Japan for so many yen or whatever it is. let's say it's the equivalent of $20. We're not going to collect Japanese sales tax. We're not going to have them tag it on to the top of the book price. We're still going to sell to the Japanese market your book at $20. Now, guess who pays the 8% tax? I do. I pay it out of my royalties. They say, well, we're simply going to deduct that from your royalties. And that's how we're going to cover it. And you have every right to raise the price of your book to the Japanese market to compensate for that 8% tax. But we're not going to charge it on top. We're not going to charge the customer on that. We're going to pay the tax to the Japanese government out of your flipping royalties. Now, what do you think of that deal? How would you like that if that worked out where you worked, where it says, well, the your boss comes out one day and says, well, the water bill just went up. So it went up 3% across the board, so to speak, if we look at what we pay our employees. So we're simply going to take the water bill out of your wages. They would probably have quite a riot on their hands. At the very least, you'd have people walking out. What am I supposed to do? I mean, Amazon's so big, they represent the man. And people have asked me about my book, Behind the Cosmic Veil, where I only have a print version. The only way you can buy Behind the Cosmic Veil is in a printed form, what they call dead trees. You can buy it out of a lot of different outlets, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can pretty much go into any bookstore, and if they don't have it on the shelf, you can order it. But you cannot get it in an electronic form. And I've had a lot of people complain about that and say, well, gee, you know, this is the modern era. You should be able to order that in electronic form, and I want to be able to digitally download it and all that. And I appreciate it. I don't mean to talk. I don't mean to speak facetiously about it. You folks that are interested in my book, God bless you. The point of it is this. The reason why I don't have an electronic version is because of the unfair trade practices that Amazon and other companies like Barnes & Noble, who sort of kind of conspire together with Amazon in a lot of different ways. They copy each other's prices and all that. That's another hidden deal behind the Amazon's theme that the general public doesn't know about unless they get involved with these things. So here's the deal. Here's how it works. They want you to sell your electronic book really low. So what they do, if you sell your electronic book for $9.99 or less, you know, a penny under $10, your royalty is 30%. If you market one penny over $10, they drop your royalty to 10%. Yeah, I'm going to pause for a sec to let you guys think about that. That means that if I have incredibly valuable intellectual content that I want to market at a higher price, I have to take a pay cut. I'm not able to equal my $10 price or my royalty at $10 until I price the electronic book up at around $20, which is pretty much what my printed book costs. And then I can get my royalties that I would get if I sold it at $10. Now people say, oh, that sounds great, man. You ought to sell it for 10 bucks because you're making the same as if you had to charge 20. That sounds great. Well, no, it's not, because I have a printed book. And a lot of people want that printed book. The other thing about a printed book, it's very, very difficult to copy. Nobody is going to sit there on a bootleg site and scan my book out in order to post my digital file somewhere on some hacker cracker site so that people can download it for free. It's not in a digital form. So people can't pirate my book like they can with all these electronic books. So the other problem is with illustrations. It becomes a bit problematic to put the illustrations, at least for me, in an electronic form. And I have my own publishing company. That's who puts out my book. I don't have to hire somebody to do all this work for me. Yes, I'm quite proficient at all that. Thank goodness. I was gifted with that kind of thing. I did all the work on my book. I did all the formatting. I did most of the designing. I did all the internal layout. I did all the spacing. My wife helped with some of the software, doing the configuration of the files, and she did a great job on the artwork on the cover of it, in my opinion, even though primarily the artwork is of my design. So when people say, well, gee, this isn't as professional looking as some books are, you can't blame my wife. That's my fault. The point is that there's no way I'm going to give up the printed book. It has great value. You can't sign a digital copy of your book at a convention or a conference or a symposium. You can't sign it. You have to sign a physical book. You can't sell physical books to people and open it up and share it with them and show them this page and that page. You can't do it with a digital copy. You have to have an actual physical book. So here's the problem. If I sell the digital copy for $10, where am I going to sell the printed book? In other words, a lot of people would just buy the $10 digital copy instead of the $20 printed book. Oh, well, what's the problem with that? Well, the problem is that a lot of people want the printed copy. Plus the fact that, as I mentioned, the printed copy can't be plagiarized. Not as easily. It can't be copied and downloaded to some hack site. So essentially what I'm doing is I have to run my own competition and cut my own throat on the printed book in order to sell the digital version at the price that Amazon and Barnes & Noble and numerous other outlets want you to do. They want you to sell it cheap. Now, why are they doing that? They're doing that because it's far less expensive for them to push a digital copy from their servers than it is to actually handle a physical book. And so it's interesting, even royalties, this is something that people don't know most of the time, that a company like Barnes & Nobles or Amazon, if you have them send a physical check to you, they will charge you a fee for that check. It could be $8, it could be $10. They'll take it right out of your royalties for the fee to write you a physical check for your flipping royalties. But they won't charge you that if you get a digital payment, which means you have to let them into your bank account. Yeah, I bet a lot of you folks didn't know all about that. So that's why I don't have digital books on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, because it's unfair, it's anti-competitive, and it really is a bum deal for the author. Now, a lot of authors go through it because they say, well, gee, we really don't have any choice. The game is rigged, and this is how we have to play in order to get into it. My position, as you folks know, is a little bit different. I didn't publish my book to write my book to make a ton of money. I wrote my book to talk about the truth, about the reality of the vision that I have as to the way the cosmos is actually put together. To me, that was far more important than how much money I was going to make. And so I was able to retain some of my personal rights, so to speak, and not sign them away in my personal privacy and not sign them away by sticking with a physical book. The point that I'm trying to make with all this is that there's so many things that go on in business, especially on the corporate level, that the general public has no conception as to what happens. And I'm just talking about a little tiny sliver of that corporate economic reality. I'm talking about that little tiny sliver that I myself are personally affected and am personally aware of it. So when it comes to shouting this chant that corporations have to pay their fair share in taxes, guess what, folks? Just like my royalty over in Japan, when they raised the taxes, it's coming out of your pocket in higher prices for goods and services. And all the people, and it makes me laugh when I look and people chant, well, our taxes are already high. We don't want raising taxes. We don't want more taxes. And then they chant that the corporation should pay its fair share in taxes. And so I shake my head and I say, you know, you guys are schizophrenic. It's an oxymoron. It's a conflict of concepts. And it's no wonder why we have the kind of politicians that we do. Because they're able to tell the lie that people want to hear. They don't want to know the truth. They want to hear the lie. Not everybody. I know there's people, especially my listeners. My listeners are by and large truth seekers. They are seeking the truth. That's why they listen to somebody like me who is a fellow truth seeker. And folks like myself provide a voice for what these people, these other people, you listeners, what you're thinking. You know, I don't talk about all that kind of new thing when it comes to, concepts. When we talk about motivations, like seeking the truth, searching for the way things work, most of my listeners are in that category. And I'm very grateful for y'all, because as fellow truth seekers, we have a meaningful relationship over this radio show. But by and large, most people don't want to seek the truth. They want to avoid the truth. They want to run away from it. They want to hide from it. They want to work deals with it. They want to work around it. They want to cheat it. And they want people to tell them the lie that they want to believe. Yeah, one of the things I think brought this all on when it came to the social media, where these subjects were coming up, was this support for Bernie Sanders, the independent, the socialist, Bernie Sanders. And this is what he keeps chanting about the income equality in the United States. Yeah, there is an income inequality. And he talks about these corporations paying their fair share. Okay, I get it. It's a populist theme and a lot of people get on board. But where's his solutions? What's he talking about as a solution? How to fix this? He isn't. He's just chanting the rabble-rouser populist view that everybody wants to sign on to and say, wow, this is great. Isn't that wonderful that this man wants to do that? But he there's no way he can do it. He doesn't know how. So what's the alternative to this? What do we have to do? We have to force corporations to not pay the taxes out of their cost of goods and services, not pass it on to the consumer, where they have to actually pay it out of their profits. Like what's working with me with Amazon, with the Japan deal. What they're saying is, we're going to force you to pay this tax out of your earnings. However, you've got the opportunity to raise your prices. And when you raise the price, that extra price will compensate for the tax. And guess who's going to pay it? Who's going to get it in the end? The consumer. They're going to pay it. If you want these guys, these politicians, to make corporations pay their fair share in taxes, it's going to come out of your pocket. You're going to be the one that pays it at the grocery store, at the department store, at the pump. Anywhere you go to buy something, you're going to be the one that pays it. So you need to wise up. I mean, when I posted this on Facebook, you could hear the crickets chirp. No one touched it. I think one person in both places where I posted it, one person either way commented on it. And they loved it. They said, man, you hit the nail on the head. You told the truth. Everybody else disappeared. The room emptied. It was like Jesus and the adulteress. When he stood up and said what he said, one by one, everybody disappeared. And, you know, that's kind of embarrassing, because I posted these on sites where there's some very intelligent and engaging people. They all ran scared. That's a shame. The real problem is this, and nobody can fix this. I tell people it's like the Three Stooges when it comes to taxes with corporations and all those kinds of things. Mo slaps Larry. Larry slaps Curly. Curly turns around to pass it on to somebody else, and there's nobody there. He gets stuck holding the bag. We're Curly. We're the consumers. When you ask these people to pay, it's going to come out of Curly. It's going to come out of us. So think about that next time you're contemplating these kinds of ideas and the politicians that are talking these ideas, because they're not telling you the whole story. We're at the bottom of the hour. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more. You're listening to Thomas Fusco on the Shifting Paradigms radio program on the IPBN FM network. We'll be back in a few. Don't go away.
Jeddah, in the M&M Survivor Challenge, the sun beats down on the empty quarter.
Hold on, Red. I need a drink. That's better.
Hey, Yellow, go easy with that water. It's got to last till Dubai.
Okay, Red. I'll be careful.
Guess how many weeks it will take Red and Yellow to cross the empty quarter desert from Jeddah to Dubai and win great M&M Survival Kit with laptop, mobile phone, and GPS tracking system, and lots more. Count the colors inside M&M's packs for a clue.
Yellow, you crazy nut, the water. It's all gone.
Ow, you don't have to hit me.
We'll never make it now.
Subway Restaurant's Storytime Theater proudly presents Jack and the Beanstalk.
Fee-fi-fo-fum. I smell something delicious. Hey, little fella, what you got there?
Oh, this? It's the big hot pastrami sub from Subway Restaurants.
Mmm, that does look tasty.
It sure is. Climbing that beanstalk out there makes you hungry.
You mind if I have a bite?
Sure! I'll trade you for that goose over there with the golden eggs.
You got a deal!
Hungry for something big? Then pick up a big hot pastrami sub from Subway Restaurants. Layer upon layer of delicious hot pastrami stacked high and toasted to flavorful perfection on freshly baked bread. Topped with pickles, mustard, and melted Swiss cheese, it's the perfect way to satisfy any giant-sized appetite. Big Hot Pastrami, available at participating restaurants for a limited time only. See restaurants for details. Subway, eat fresh.
I remember a loud noise, and then everything went black.
I was set on fire, and I couldn't breathe.
I saw the fireball. Everybody was panicking. I have never been so afraid in my life.
Everything changed after that.
I'm Trace Adkins. I want to tell you about these true American heroes and how you can show your thanks by helping them through Wounded Warrior Project.
The person who went to Iraq is by far not the same person that came back.
I was very isolated. I didn't want to talk to anybody.
I felt like there was no one there. There was no hope.
There's this feeling of brokenness, not being the person that I used to be. I had thoughts of end of my life.
Your gift today of $19 a month can help us provide the programs and services desperately needed by our wounded service members.
When a person is scared and confused and alone, Wounded Warrior Project has been there to help them.
The needs aren't going away. Post-traumatic stress disorder is not going away.
The Wounded Warriors that are out there need help. They're going to be around for years to come.
Call or go online with a pledge of $19 a month, and you'll receive this Wounded Warrior Project blanket.
I'm able to do a lot more now. I have come a long way.
It's so much emotional healing that goes on.
It's great to know that there's an organization out there who's willing and able to help.
The job of helping thousands of our wounded warriors rebuild their lives is massive. That's why your gift of $19 a month is so important. Please, call or go online right now.
All right, folks, and we're back for the second half of this crazy radio show called Shifting Paradigms with your host, Thomas Fusco, on the IPBN-FM network. And as I said, it's open chat Tuesday, so I haven't had anybody enter anything into the chat room yet that they wanted me to talk about. But if you want, you're certainly welcome to do that. Please come to www.ipbn-fm.com and listen and click on the listen chat link at the top of the page. You'll be taken to the chat room and you'll be given a very strange, funny name. We've talked about that lots of times. And just change it or keep the moochie goo or whatever it gives you and put in a topic and we'll try to address it and talk about it. And by the way, as I mentioned at the top of the show, that we don't have our phone lines manned tonight, so we don't have any call-in numbers, which is okay because lots of people rather would chat in a room anyway than dial it up. And it's just a lot easier. It's just a digital age. It's what we do. It's what we listen to. It's how we work. Anyway, I was talking about corporate America there and about taxes in the first part of the show and how corporations just simply don't pay income taxes. Their customers pay it in increased costs of goods and services. And I gave the example of my deal with Amazon where they want me to pay the Japanese consumption tax of 8%, the new tax. Out of my pocket, instead of them collecting it from the Japanese buyer. They want to take it, they're going to collect it from me. And if I want to collect it from the Japanese buyer, I have to raise my prices. And so this is the same kind of deal that goes on nationally with corporations. And so they're going to pass it on. This is what corporations do. Now, somebody might say, oh, we need to force the government, or the government needs to force corporations to pay the extra taxes but not raise prices. Think about that. Think about that very carefully, because you're going down a very, very slippery slope there. When you have a government that dictates what products are sold for. Hey, Nixon, back in the 70s, in order to try to fight the new inflation that was happening, an unprecedented level of inflation that was instigated in part by taking the valuable metals, the backing of silver, out of the currency, that helped instigate it, and doing away with the United States note, which was a dollar bill printed by our Treasury Department. Pull out any kind of a dollar, 20, 10, 5, 1, out of your pocket and take a look what it says. It says that it's a Federal Reserve note. That's from a private banking corporation. Back in the early 60s, we had a United States note also. And if you read it, it says that it was backed and issued by the Treasury of the United States. And unfortunately, shortly after John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and he was a great champion of the Treasury note, which was something a lot of people weren't against. You get the conspiracy theorists to say that this was one of the reasons why they knocked Kennedy off, because of his support of the United States note. And his resistance to do away with it and just lean on the Federal Reserve. Shortly after Johnson took the oath of office as the vice president, passing up to the presidency, one of the early things that he did was he repealed the United States note. He did away with it. And it used to have a red seal. The Federal Reserves have a green seal. Some people have seen the silver certificates that have the blue seal. The United States note that was issued by the Treasury Department had a red seal. And of course, the silver certificate was also issued by the Treasury. It would pay the bearer on demand the face value in real currency and lawful money, it said, in silver. So we have this inflation that started going rampant in the early 70s, and Nixon tried to put an end to it by instituting price fixes, price freezes. He froze the prices on everything so that no corporation, no supplier, nobody could raise any prices. And it was an absolute disaster. It was never, ever tried again. So the only way to make a corporation to quote unquote pay its fair share, make it do that without it coming out of the consumer's pocket, is to fix prices, is to tell them that you can't raise your prices for any reason, but you still have to pay us the tax that we're now charging you. A formula for economic disaster, calamity. Now, what's the other alternative? The other alternative would have control boards. We do have those for utilities, where a utility has to go before a governmental board to get price raises, price increases, and they have to justify those increases, and then the board approves it or denies it. I don't see anybody's utility bill that has stopped from going up because they get their price increases from the board anyway. It's almost like a charade. However, can you imagine the federal government? That bureaucracy, as big and as clumsy and as screwed up as it is, can you imagine them having a control board that would hear the pleas for price increases from every corporation in the United States? From every business in the United States would have to go in front of a government board to raise prices? I mean, I'm being silent for a second just to let that sink in. You know, you have to, in everything, you have to look past the surface of the onion. You can't just look at the skin. You have to start peeling it back and look at the layers underneath. And I'm not talking about anything that takes some giant Einsteinian brain to figure out. I'm just taking logic that you would apply in your everyday life, in buying and selling, in weighing what you take in as opposed to what you put out, where it's going and for what reason. That kind of logic that we all as consumers and workers have to use. That's all I'm saying, but just apply it on this larger scale, and you see how insane it is. Yeah, you want the government to control the corporations? They did that in fascist Italy, and yep, Mussolini indeed made the trains run on time. He did. It's still said to this day that at least Mussolini made the trains run on time. Sure. A fear of absolute calamity, otherwise, death or whatever, imprisonment. Of course, he made the trains run on time, but the cost was too high. It was too great. And in fact, that's why, in part, why his own citizens rebelled against him eventually. And they, you know, had that public lynching in the square where they killed him right out on the street. So this does not have an easy answer and an easy solution. Better think twice before you start chanting, let corporations pay their fair share. It's the same thing with this $15 an hour minimum wage. I think it's a wonderful idea. I don't think you would really find anyone of any heart anywhere that wouldn't want people to get paid more money. But there are consequences to that, too. Number one, the consumer's going to pay for it. There's no way that you're going to make the corporation take that out of its profits. It's got to be reflected in higher prices. It's going to happen. Now, maybe the price isn't much at McDonald's, but when you start adding every minimum wage up and raising it to that kind of money, it's going to come out of our pockets. Now, if you want to pay for it, that's fine. You think that's a noble thing, that's fine. But the people who will be hurt the worst are the people that are at the bottom of the economic rung. And the people chanting for a high minimum wage, they're saying, well, we support the poor. We support the underprivileged. We support the people who are struggling to make ends meet. That's why we're doing this. Well, it's going to go right out the door again. Let alone the benefits that these people receive in public assistance that they won't receive anymore because their income now is too high. It disqualifies them. That's not talked about either. Now, I'm not saying that these things are not real problems. Please, please, please don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that these things are not real problems. I'm just saying that there are no simple answers, and you have to think about all these different factors to see if you can come up with a solution, if there is any. For some of these things, there is no solution. What I talked about is pretty much the same in most every part of the world. It's not just America. Everywhere, most of the world's population is curly. It's like I said, the Moes and the Larrys run the world. Curly is us. We're the common guy. We're the person on the street. We're the worker that goes out and breaks our butts and makes what money we can. Even small businesses, they're in the same shoot. They're not any different than we are. They work a lot harder and they make more money usually. Sometimes they don't make as much. There's times I didn't make as much where I thought, gee, you know, in this certain particular period of my self-employment, I'd be making more money sweeping the floor at Quickie King. You have to think about this carefully. You have to really think about it in detail. And don't just take the stupid, simple pat response up front and say, gee, this looks great. Let's go for it. There's always a deeper story. Now, the other part of this that I wanted to talk about was the idea of American jobs. They took our jobs. Immigrants, but more importantly, when they're against corporations, it's pronounced against corporations, it's about these corporations moving overseas. And that we should prevent them from moving overseas. Now, that's a complex issue also. First of all, we're in a global economy. There's no way that we can take an isolationist point of view. We can't do it anymore. It's impossible. We can't crawl back into that late 1900 or 1800 shell. It just isn't going to work. Our corporations have to compete with other corporations around the world. And what do we buy here? We buy, by and large, cheap imported goods. Oh, well, we don't have any choice. We have to do that. That's all in the store. That's not our problem. It's not our doing. Oh, but yes, it is. It is our doing. And this is another thing I wrote about. And I think I'm just going to read it to you. This is from a post that I made in Facebook. This was another one, folks, that when I put it up there, the crickets started chirping. The room got empty. Nobody said a word about it. And that's pretty shameful. But I'm old enough to remember this. And so this is the article. I'll just read it off to you. The title of it was, what I wrote was, Just One Tale of the 1960s Corporate Tragedy. And this is what I wrote. I've been doing some private research on antique Christmas lighting and came across one of the uncountable corporate tragedies of a powerful U.S. company brought down by cheap Japanese imports. Now, this is what caused it. This is what created the problem. Was cheap Japanese imports. That's where all this these issues began, with these imported goods and the loss of American jobs. And so this is something that I thought was important to share with people, because I'm old enough to remember when all this happened. Young people don't. They think we always lived in a world like this, or I don't know what it is that they think. And this is what I wrote. I've seen a lot of posts lately about the iniquity of corporate taxes versus private individuals and other related anti-corporation rhetoric. I posted responses to the tax question by explaining what no politician will reveal, that no corporation pays taxes. We've talked about this already in the first part of the show. All the Bernie Sanders followers don't know that they will be the ones paying the taxes out of their own pocket. And then I wrote, duh. The rabble-rousers all fall silent after I post this comment. Wonder why. There's also been posts about loss of American jobs and U.S. companies moving overseas. I posted the following in response, which also brought on the proverbial chirping of crickets as all the rabble-rousers fled the building. And here's what I wrote. I've been doing some private research on antique Christmas lighting and came across one of the uncountable corporate tragedies of a powerful U.S. company brought down by cheap Japanese imports. With the widespread installation of residential electric power in the early 1900s, many companies began producing electric lighting for decorating Christmas trees. In 1925, a number of key players in this field united to form the NOMA, Trade Association, the National Outfit Manufacturers Association. Originally, and for some years, they called strings of Christmas lights outfits, Christmas outfits. That's how they were marketed. That's what they were called. The following year, 1926, in an almost unprecedented move, 15 of this association's members joined to form a single private corporation called the NOMA Electric Corporation, using the name NOMA after the original trade association's acronym, NOMA. With the combined power of these entities and holding a valuable patent for the easy joining together of individual strands of light by the consumer, NOMA soon became by far the largest manufacturer of Christmas lighting in the world. This U.S. company introduced numerous innovations in the trade that are still in use today, like the fused safety plug and the safety socket with flow-through solderless design. That socket is used in very many electrical circuitry boards, including computers, but especially in networking and phone companies, phone services. This was invented by NOMA. Meanwhile, here we go, folks. This is one of the behind-the-scenes rest of the story. Gee, I should have thought of this. Meanwhile, the Allies' efforts to convert a post-war Japan from a military culture to a modern industrial manufacturing base was firmly established by the 1950s, including the fact that we facilitated the supply sources for all of that Japanese manufacturer base needs. We set it up all for them and turned the key and said, here, go do this now instead of thinking of war. After the last occupation, trade restrictions were lifted in 1952, the prior years that produced those items that we're familiar made in occupied Japan. They're collector's items, but that occupied Japan requirement was dropped in 1952. And they were basically let free to do what they wanted and needed to do. The manufacture and export of cheap, plentiful goods proliferated within the Christmas lighting market. And again, I'm talking about one tiny sliver of the U.S. economy. I mean, Christmas lights stand for very little compared to all other kinds of goods and services that were being provided at that time from U.S.-based firms. Within the Christmas lighting market, these imports hurt GE and Westinghouse with cheap light bulbs, two U.S. companies that previously had a near monopoly on this product. If you bought a light bulb for your Christmas string, it would have either been GE or Westinghouse. The most damage was the production of miniature Christmas lights, which the Japanese instituted, resembling the LED strings we buy today, but made from incandescent bulbs. They were poorly made compared to U.S. products. The bulbs were permanently fused to the cords and could not be replaced and did not meet UL standards, but they were cheap. And U.S. consumers began buying them in droves. By the mid to late 1950s, American manufacturers began feeling the pressure as there was no way they could compete with these cheap products on pricing. To make matters worse, the U.S. consumer, that's us, folks, beep, 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 here it is. The U.S. consumer showed they didn't care about the poor quality as long as the price was low. And we didn't, and we still don't. As long as we can get it cheap, we did that. U.S. Christmas lighting companies began to incorporate more and more imported components into their products in a desperate attempt to keep up. This economic blow, which we ourselves instigated by the way we chose to rehabilitate Japan, hey, that's us, we did it, was followed by another that no one could have foreseen. Around 1960, companies began producing artificial Christmas trees made out of aluminum. Most will remember seeing examples of these. While somewhat ugly by today's standards, they took off like wildfire, and millions of these artificial trees were sold annually. Because of the electrically conductive nature of these metal trees, it was no longer considered safe to string electric lights on them, and so the market moved substantially towards floor standing, rotating colored wheels that projected the changing colors onto the shiny metal trees. And everybody has seen an image of that or seen it personally. Sale of electric string lights sagged. By 1963, Noma, who was this giant company, was trying to stay afloat by relabeling and reselling inventory bought out by other failing Christmas light companies, which by this time were dropping like flies. In 1967, this once mighty U.S. company, which dominated the world market only a few years before, filed for bankruptcy. The Noma name then became merely a trademark that has been bought and sold numerous times throughout the ensuing years. The same thing happened to many famous U.S. names in all kinds of fields. Emerson, for example, once a proud producer of electronics, is now just a trade name being bought and sold, prompting a standard joke in the industry, who owns them this week? Because really, anytime an Emerson product comes out, we don't know who owns them now. Who is responsible for this great company's demise? U.S. company, along with countless others, and the loss of all those American jobs. Who's responsible, ladies and gentlemen? Not the politicians or corporate CEOs. We are. We watched it happen callously and uncaringly as we greedily filled our bellies with cheap imports, just as Nero fiddled away while watching Rome burn. True or false? Here comes the crickets chirping. Why don't you see such posts elsewhere on Facebook? You know why. There's no self-satisfaction when you can't blame others for our woes and no self-justification from a victim mentality. You won't gather many friends, win sympathizers and popularity, nor garner many likes. And then I ended it. Can anyone at all, give me even one good reason why the surviving U.S. corporations should give a rat's tail about the American consumer or American jobs. And with that, folks, we're at the end of the show. If you could think of a reason why U.S. corporations could give a hoot about American jobs and American workers, save it up and write to me in the chat room next week, and we'll talk about it. We'll have a conversation. Call in, and we'll debate it. This is food for thought. Really think about it. You've been listening to Thomas Fusco on the Shifting Paradigms radio program on the IPBN-FM network. Thanks a lot for tuning in, guys. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.